Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Marcus Hippie.
On today's show, we'll be talking all things Tropicália, the musical movement that started in Brazil in the late 60s and which is celebrating 50 years of top tunes this year. Singer Nina Miranda will be explaining the message in the music.
We'll also be hearing from fashion guru and writer Simon Doonan. His new book, Saturday Night Fever Pitch, looks at fashion's relationship with football and why the World Cup is the ultimate runway of new looks.
And actor Rupert Everett will be discussing his life and career at the end of the programme.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's own treasured Brazilian export, well, import maybe, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with next week's news. And there'll be more music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly, Monocle 24.
It's been a nice weekend. It's been a busy week at work, obviously. It's been a nice weekend as well. I know Fernando is queuing to get into the studio from behind the glass. I have to say he looks surprisingly fresh because you know what happened yesterday? I was celebrating this summer at Fernando's rooftop reception and that was quite a late night.
Okay, well let's get him in and see how that went and more importantly find out what's going to happen in the news next week. There was something. Well, we want to hear what's happening next week. Where are you going to begin?
It's going to be a busy week. Let's start in Colombia, which is voting for their new president today. And according to the polls, I mean, I'm not saying that we should, you know, rely on them, but apparently Van Duque, the center-right candidate, he's set to win. I think the polls is like 5 to 10% ahead. And it's interesting because people ask, you know, he's very young. He will be the youngest Colombian president if he's elected.
Only how old?
42 years old. So, you know, he would join like Trudeau and Macron as this young generation. But is he a modernizer? I don't think so. I mean, for example, you know that Colombia just did a peace process with FARC, and that's his opinion on it. He said the whole peace process was a prize for criminals and a monument to impunity. So certainly he would change some elements of this process, which is quite worrying, because I think Colombia is a country that in Latin America is doing generally well, a stable economy, a decreasing violence. So I'm not sure if this would be good news or not for Colombia.
Do we know anything else about his policies? Has he made many promises?
Well, I think he'll be very kind of tough on crime. One of his main allies is Álvaro Uribe, which is the former Colombian president, extremely right-wing. And I have to say that his candidate, the center-left candidate, Gustavo Petro, was a former guerrilla member as well. So I think, you know, Colombians have two opposite ends of the spectrum. I don't think this time they don't have like a centrist candidate in a way. I must say as well that Colombia is one of the most populous, one of the biggest economies of the region. So it's a very important election. It can have a strong effect in the country.
Yeah, and I think most commentators have been saying the only thing that you can be sure of is not going to be the same as what's gone before. This is a moment of a change for Colombia and its policies, especially towards the FARC. But where next?
Well, fashion. It's time for menswear. And of course, our Jamie, he's been in PT. It's Milan Fashion Week at the moment, but Paris Fashion Week starts this Tuesday. And I think, to be honest, it's my favorite. I think Paris does excellent, well, of course, women's wear, but men's wear as well. And people say, oh, is this the end of women's wear? I don't like when people say this. I think there's still so much to be seen. And I think
you mean of men's wear?
Yeah, in the men's wear world.
I mean, okay.
There's been some crises. I think some brands are showing the women's wear, like Gucci, for example. But, you know, for example, in Paris, we have King Jones. He was at Louis Vuitton, which I loved his work there. He's doing his first time at Dior Homme. I'm very curious to see where he's taking the brand. And Louis Vuitton actually has a new one as well, which is Virgil Abloh. And, you know, he's been this kind of the sportswear guy from Off-White. I think it'd be interesting to see the changes he would do. So plenty of excitement there as well. And some interesting trends. I wonder, you know, if you guys like, I think this trend of sportswear is still very much, there'll be a lot of track suits and not so much suits, which is a shame sometimes.
I kind of like that sometimes, no, it's quite relaxed.
Well, it's the only reason that it's not relaxed because
you're trying. Why is Andrew laughing?
Well, I'm never worried about you being that stressed in your suit at work because you don't actually rock up in a suit. Is it more relaxed in your jeans, do you think?
I'm not sure
that I want to see you in
Andrew, I'd like to remind you that I think that when I came to Monocle for the first time, I think I may have worn a suit.
Okay, well, that's good, but I'm not sure I want you to slide all the way down to loungewear.
No tracksuits in the office, I can promise.
And sometimes they don't fit that nicely, those tracksuits. I mean, you do need to have a certain physique in a way. So I think sometimes a man in a suit, it's something so comfortable and easy to pick it up. I actually don't think tracksuits are that comfortable at times.
What next?
Well, ugly dogs. I don't know what's my opinion on this, but, you know, it happens in California every year. It attracts a lot of media attention. It's been going on since the 70s. And the winner for the ugliest dog actually get a prize of $1,500 and a free trip to New York. But I feel sorry for the dogs because, you know, they don't know what's happening. I brought some pictures here for you guys.
I mean, how ugly do they have to be in order to win this competition?
Just look at the picture of Sam.
Oh, my
you
God.
Know, it's a Chinese crested dog. He won 3 times in a row. I have to say, it's very sad, but San died. Just to give you a little background. But yeah, I think she's blind and she doesn't have any hair.
Andrew, what do you want to describe what you see in these pictures?
Well, it does look a bit extraterrestrial. It's got no hair. It's got like buck teeth and is blind. Poor little thing. It didn't kind of have much luck in the looks department when it was born. But hey, people loved it and have looked after it. And that's the most important thing.
I'm sure you will never take Macy because Macy is a wonderful dog, right, Andrew, to this competition.
Nice. And then there's another dog which has got like the biggest slathery, drooling, dribbly kind of mouth you've ever seen. It's like, ooh.
What do you think of the other? Exactly, I think that's Martha.
Okay.
The Neapolitan Mastiff.
I think she's just a bit messy and, according to the owner, gassy. But she was the winner last year as well.
Oh, well, it's going to be some stiff competition, I can say.
And it's funny that Animal Planet used to broadcast this event live as well. I'm not sure if it will be broadcast live this year, but it is a massive event in the dog community.
I tell you what's good about it is that you often see these kind of really sad stories of like dogs that get caught in dog pens for, you know, months and months and months because they don't match up to some kind of perfect ideal of, you know, what people think a dog should look like. You know, they're not pedigree, they're not a cute little chihuahua, and those dogs often have a horrible time. So it's great that if they kind of get people to rethink about, you know, what love means for a dog, and if some other animals get out of the pen, good for them.
That's a very beautiful
well said.
Thank you very much, Fernando, for this roundup of what to keep an eye on this coming week. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, and in a moment we'll be hearing from Nina Miranda about the history and future of Tropicalia music.
The sound of Tropicalia music, inventive songs combining Brazilian, African, pop and rock influences, have become synonymous with Brazil's flair for creating new art from its diverse diaspora. You're currently listening to Bat Mocumba by Gilberto Gil, a classic of the genre. But the birth of Tropicalia came from less blissful beginnings than some of the music suggests. In the late 60s, artists were creating new sounds in reaction to oppression from Brazil's recently installed dictatorship.
2018 marks 50 years since the landmark album release Tropicalia Upani Ai Circenses, featuring songs from greats such as Caetano Veloso, Gilberto Gil, Os Mutantes and more. And on Sunday, June the 24th in London, Brazil-born singer Nina Miranda will be celebrating with a concert, Tropicalia Calling, and she joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Could you first tell us more about what exactly happened in Brazil 50 years ago, about the birth of this music genre?
Well, there'd been Bossa Nova and there was the Beatles starting to get more and more experimental, and Brazilian, as you were saying, there's the African influence, there's all these influences that come in. Even Carmen Miranda was influenced by tango and music from all over the globe. Then there's, in contrast to that, there's a dictatorship, a really brutal dictatorship where everyone was censored. So you had to be very clever about getting your messages across. People also needed music to lighten the mood. So this rebellious streak could come out on stage. So, for example, Rita Lee would come on stage dressed as a bridesmaid, but with these kind of black kinky boots that they wore in London in the 60s. and the atmosphere in the audience, there'd be these competitions every year of the best song, and it felt like a really rowdy kind of sixth form party, you know, where it had been formal was suddenly becoming quite chaotic, and all this kind of joy and pain went into the music.
Now, was that joy and pain reflected also in the lyrics, or were the lyrics careful to not insult anyone or not upset anybody in power?
They had to be really careful, and those who weren't, for example, Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, weren't careful enough, and they got sent off to an exile to Great Britain. So they ended up living in Notting Hill and London, which then influenced their music all over again, and that then went back to Brazil. So in a way, the censorship ended up making them go even deeper, really.
But does it strike you now when you hear these songs being played, you know, in European bars, in cocktail bars, as kind of pleasant music to have, that actually, that if only people knew the story behind it, that there's so much more?
Yeah, well, actually, Bossa Nova is probably played more. And then this thing that happened, which was kind of trip-hop and smooth, almost pret-a-manger bossa nova, where it got a bit sanitised. Tropicália, because it's a bit jarring at times, like you put it on, even like now if I listen to Sgt. Pepper's, I found it much easier when I was a child. But now life is so chaotic that it's like our heads are so chaotic, we almost can't take it. And Tropicália is a bit like that, like and you're like, yeah, you know, you're nodding your head. And then it suddenly does something really weird, like a really jarring chord, which is almost what it's like walking in Brazil. So in Brazil, you're like, dun, 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 and then you see the military police. Like, it's so surreal. It's a nightmare and it's a fantasy at the same time. And that's what Tropicália is.
Well, I should bring in Fernando, who is our resident Brazilian on the Monocle 24 team, and was very excited about you coming in, because I know you've got some questions as well, Fernando.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I wonder what Nina's thing about this, because Tropicália also showed the cool side of Brazil, because I think Brazil is well known as, you know, this nice, sunny country, but I think Tropicália showed our creativity, and quite, as you mentioned, sometimes some songs can be a bit jarring, you know, not only like simple bossa nova as well. Do you think it was a very important thing for Brazil culture exports after the Tropicália movement?
Definitely,
as well.
And it's so cool that you look at the artwork now and you think, it's still fresh, it's still sophisticated, it's deep, and it's got the kind of pop art Andy Warhol, it's quite Peter Blake-ish as well at times. It's still completely relevant. And also that thing of hippies, what do? They're just kind of lounging around smoking. It's like, actually, art can end up saying quite a lot of things. And I think artists do have a platform to say things that other people can't really get away with.
Shall we listen to some Tropicália music? Now, this first clip is by Caetano Veloso and it's called Irene.
Oh, I love this song.
Un, dois, três.
Eu quero ir, minha gente, eu não sou daqui. Eu não tenho nada. Quero ver Irene rir. Quero ver Irene dar sua risada.
That was Irene by Caetano Veloso. How much can you tell us about Caetano Veloso?
I can tell you that in this song, he was in exile and he was saying, I'm not here, people. I'm not from here. I don't understand anything. You know, I don't have anything. I just want to hear Irene hir. I want to hear her laugh. I want to hear her give me her laughter.
And it's quite sad almost, making this tropical music while sitting in West London or, you know, out of your country and having such a kind of, I don't know, it just feels a little bit sad.
Existential crisis.
Yes.
He's this major star in Brazil, walking around in, you know, a thong, you know, a hippie thong, and everybody loves him, and he's tanned, and it's sunny, and you have juice every morning, and suddenly you're in England, and you can't even ask for a Coke in the pub, because what's wrong with you? What kind of man are you, eh?
He wrote a beautiful song called London, London as well, which is a little bit of a tribute to the city. You
know,
and he's still going on. That's you know, we're talking about the influence of Tropicália. Do you still see elements of Tropicália in Brazil this day, especially, I mean, we're living actually not exactly a dictatorship, but quite a difficult moment.
The most difficult moment and the most fertile moment in music, I would say right now in Brazil, there's so much exciting stuff happening, which is partly why we're doing this concert on the 24th of June, because you have these big stars like Gilberto Gil, who is one of the fathers of Tropicália, and his son is actually going to be playing at this show because Yeah, so they're the backing band, and it's like this is their chance to really be heard themselves as well.
This concert you're taking part in, I know it's an anniversary, but does it feel much more than that then? Does it feel that the music has a relevance for you again?
Yeah,
now?
Exactly. They're saying that a lot of people say it's a coup d'etat in Brazil, that Lula was an extremely popular president and he's been done under corruption charges and he's suddenly in prison and people can't vote for him, and the who's in charge now has got 1% popularity, and he's coming down hard on Afro-Brazilian religions, and there's a big evangelical element of the government now, and they're stopping, for example, Elza Soares, who in a way is a tropicalista, she's being censored. They don't like her saying, and the title of the album, God is a Woman. They're not happy about that.
Well, we had an amazing moment a few years ago where she came in here and did a concert in the building with the craziest team of people who came along. She had her great sunglasses on. It was in our canteen, that whole thing unfolded.
She sang in the canteen.
Exactly. And I think I've never seen Fernando more excited than that day when she was performing over here.
And listen, it was my first week in my new job, and I was like, what? That was a Swahili play.
And amazing, because all these Brazilian people heard that she was going to be here, so all these people just turned up. It was like it was, and she was already not very well, so she was, you know, she was seated the whole time. But once she started, that growl of the voice,
she's my alter ego. So I've done quite a few songs. I'm just like, okay, imagine I'm Elza Soares in 1970s, a nightclub, and this whole other me comes out.
Amazing. Let's continue with one more clip, by the way. Earlier we discussed already Caetano Veloso and Irene, and we concluded that it's a sad song. I wonder if Os Mutantes' song A Minha Menina is any more optimistic.
Definitely more optimistic.
That was Os Mutantes. What were they singing about?
She is my little girl and I am her little boy.
Quite revolutionary songs then.
Yeah. But son and the real na na na. It's kind of cheeky, isn't it?
But that 60s twang in the back as well. It feels like, you know, Nancy Sinatra or something with that same echo. Could you just tell us a little bit about your life? Because when people are listening to you, they can hear you have a perfect English accent, because you're half English. What's your relationship with Brazil, and how's the music come into your life?
Well, born in Brazil, father Brazilian, mother English, they met in Paris in 1968, which is this time we're talking about, during the French Revolution, well, the student revolution. And then I came to England when I was 8, and I feel like Caetano Veloso. I find England jarring, but whenever I say that, then I go, actually, I mean, what a place for music.
How did this Brazilian music come into your life? Because, again, you're sitting here in London as an exile, almost as an 8-year-old.
Yeah, well, an exile, exactly. I never wanted to leave, my God. But, yeah, Brazil's my music is a way of keeping me there. And it really does keep me there. So I get offered to do a gig, so then I get that pace of the ticket, and then I'm there. And it just inspires me so much, especially when it's cold and grey here. Then I can create my own Brazil in my studio.
Do you want to create a little bit of Brazil while you're here? Because actually, you've brought in some elements which you can explain to us how they fit into the music as well, a little maybe.
Well, I was thinking, you know, it, just in case things got dull, I could just... But it's not really been very dull, so there's not really much point in me doing anything. See, immediately we feel sad, don't we? So then we have to add music to cheer it up.
Yeah, I don't think we've had a dull moment, so we're doing very well so far.
Nina, I'm wondering, now that you're getting prepared for the concert you're having on Sunday the 24th, if we look at this Tropicália music movement 50 years ago, how much did it accomplish in the end? Did it make a difference in Brazil?
It really got people's backs up at the time. You know, they were like, we had this beautiful music with piano and acoustic guitar, and now you're bringing in all these electric guitars, the same way they did with Bob Dylan. And I think you just have to shake things up. I don't think you can pretend that everything's the same when it's been absolutely being bulldozed. Bossa Nova we don't even realise when you don't speak Portuguese how amazing the lyrics are. They've got these very sanitised American translations that just made it about a pretty girl walking down, whatever. And in fact, they're very deep and soulful songs. But Brazil was going through a very exciting time. It was doing well. It was prosperous. There was integration. Everything was moving forward. And this dictatorship just messed with it all. So now again, I think no one can be quiet. We can't just sit back and be quiet, because music can stimulate the intellect, it can bring us together, it can get us off our phones, it can get us talking and realising that together we are many.
Thank you very much, Nina. And Nina Miranda and others will be appearing at the Tropicália Calling Concert at London's Total Refreshment Centre venue on Sunday, June 24th, as already mentioned. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Woo!
Let's continue with some new music now. This is from Nina Miranda's most recent album, Freedom of Movement. This is The Cage and the Garden.
That was our lovely guest, Nina Miranda, with Cage in the Garden from her most recent record, Freedom of Movement. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The World Cup kicked off this week, and the globe's best players will be looking to make the biggest impact. But the pitch isn't the only place they do it. For the modern footballer, some fashionable flair in the dressing up box is also an essential part of their ID.
Simon Doonan is the creative ambassador for Barneys in New York and a fashion columnist too. Earlier, he joined Tom Edwards to discuss the relationship between football and fashion, the topic of his new book, Saturday Night Fever Pitch, The Madness and Magic of Football Style. Tom began by asking whether Simon's boyhood fascination with George Best is where the story really begins.
I think there's two stories, actually. There's definitely a George Best story, because I was born in the 50s, 1952. I'm absolutely ancient. Think Methuselah. You know, we clawed our way out of austerity Britain, me, us baby boomers, and all of a sudden, bang, the swinging 60s happen, along come the Beatles, and along come George Best. So it was almost as if the world went from black and white to Technicolor. And at the centre of it are obviously these pop stars and the fifth Beatle, George Best, who, you know, became a symbol of that post-austerity, swinging, groovy, hedonistic, colourful, self-indulgent, crazy, etc.
And do you think that he would have appreciated what he unleashed? Because it did feel like this story, the sort of the excesses of the stories that you paint so vividly in this book, in words and of course in the pictures, which we can talk about in a minute. Do you think he was aware that he was changing the narrative almost single-handedly at that time?
I suspect he was very much in his own little head. You know, Eamon Dunphy, he's a player turned writer. Do you know him, Eamon Dunphy?
A legend.
Yeah, a legend.
On the other side of the Irish Sea as well.
Yeah, that's what I figured. So he recalls his time playing with George, and he says that even after training, George would shampoo his hair, comb it, bung on the aftershave, and it was almost like it was like George was going dancing every day. And I thought there's something blissfully sort of life-affirming and life-enhancing about that kind of vanity where you're always getting a bit tarted up, like you're going dancing every day. And there's a lesson there for us all, don't you think?
Absolutely. And you get these periodic sort of celebrations of football. Obviously, we're talking just, I guess, in the week preceding the World Cup, which is happening in Russia, which is maybe still wrestling with some of those sort of 80s issues in terms of football and people's rights and all the rest of it, which maybe we won't get into. But what kind of a platform does the World Cup still provide to see the international excesses of some of this? Because obviously the World Cup's good, isn't it? Because there's still, we know a lot of these players, they're playing in the big leagues and all the rest of it, but there's still a chance for maybe a couple of left field people to I don't know, maybe feature in volume two of your book, this kind of thing? Are you looking forward to seeing how everyone measures up in Russia?
I don't want to sound like Mary Poppins. Actually, I do want to sound like Mary Poppins. Anything that brings people together, you know, we talk a lot about how divided people are and blah, blah, blah. And it's obviously there's some issues, but anything that brings people together is a groovy thing, a sweet thing. Did that sound like Mary Poppins?
100%, and all the better for it. And the other thing we'll see, maybe some wags. There's a fun section in here about it. One of my favourite pictures, certainly, was Jeff Hurst with his kids. Is that homemade haberdashery outfit? I don't even know how to do that justice on
I love that picture. And Jeff Hurst from the 1966 team. Obviously, the wife has had the Singer sewing machine out and made outfits for the kids that I think match her outfit, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's his daughter. She doesn't look happy with the outcome there, does she? That's a long face right
Well,
there.
It's like bell bottoms with gingham inserts.
The next could be making a comeback. I'll give it a go. I'll give everything a try once. Tell me, what was the most fun section to work on? Because I've already alluded to this. We do a little bit on the haircuts, the tattoos, the cars, which is a great read. The managers as well, which is often forgotten, and they're responsible for some of the most egregious, certainly fashion offences down the years. I often think of David Pleat, that one, when he was running as a Luton manager in his sort of off-white beige suit. I don't know what... I think he's spared. Exactly. Was there a particular section that was the most fun to research and write?
Well, you mentioned the managers, yes. Because I was so familiar with the fashion stuff, the ink and the haircuts. The managers really required a lot of diligent reading on my part. I enjoyed it tremendously. And I read Barney Roney's book about managers, which is absolutely brilliant and incredibly funny. He should get on telly more and do more history books. He's got that ability to make history very interesting and funny. So the managers, yeah, and the managers are interesting because they kind of divide up into the sort of Savile Row brigade and then the spiffy Eurofabulous guys like Pep Guardiola, who they look like managers, but they look like the manager of the Prada store in Milan. You know, super spiffy, tailored jacket, narrow tie. He looks like a sort of high-end haute couture undertaker. You know, really, really pulled together. Whereas the Brits are still really going back to that Savile Row, I'm a bank manager. Because, you know, with managers, they're responsible now for a lot of money.
Yeah, well, they're CEOs in a way, aren't they, as much as they are coaches.
Yeah, you can't wear a leopard jumpsuit if you're a manager. You have to look like someone with a bit of gravitas who can be responsible for money. That's why managers in general loathe fashion, and they always have. You know, there's famous stories about Frank Worthington showing up to fly off with Alf Ramsey. And Alf Ramsey looks at him, and Frank Worthington is basically looking like cross between Dennis Hopper and Midnight Cowboy. And he just freaks. Can I say what he said?
Absolutely.
He says, "What the fuck have I done?" Like right across the airport really loudly. Anyway, because managers thought, see, style, funky haircuts, man jewelry, they see it as being alternative ideas that are going to infect the team, because they're constantly trying to keep the team not infected by strange ideas. Because in a way, they've got a point, because the players are very young and they're quite suggestible. So, you know, they want to keep them very focused. And fashion historically was seen as a huge distraction. I mean, you know the story about Fergie making Bex go and shave off his mohawk and stuff like that. I kind of don't blame him. And now David Beckham says, yeah, he was sort of right. You know, it was Wembley.
And this is what I think struck me particularly sort of reading the book, is that there is this idea of these things as distraction, and there's these players, and they're often derided, particularly the ones who, okay, it's fine if Beckham does it, it was certainly fine if George Best did it, but for the lesser lights, but they still have the affectations without maybe the playing substance. Is it a distraction, though? I mean, did you sort of document, and again, as you sort of read around it and talk to people that you feature in the book, you know, people like Pirlo, who's proud of his beautiful hair, and it was majestic on the pitch for 20 years or more. So it doesn't necessarily mean that your eye is taken off the ball, if you like.
Well, the way I look at it, if you're Dani Alves or Neymar or Firmino or any of these guys, Pogba, I call them psychedelic ninjas, because they basically will wear anything as long as it's avant-garde, outre, etc., you better be really good.
Simon Doonan there discussing his book Saturday Night Fever Pitch, The Madness and Magic of Football Style. Stay tuned. We're going to be hearing from Rupert Everett in just a moment. Rupert Everett began his career on the stage starring in the play Another Country and later in its film adaptation, both to great acclaim. His roles in 1994's The Madness of King George and 1999's Shakespeare in Love also won praise. But it was his portrayal of George, the gay best friend of Julia Roberts' character in the romantic comedy from 1997, My Best Friend's Wedding, that caught the attention of Hollywood. Not knowing what to do with a gay leading man, however, many offers from Hollywood soon dried up.
But never one to walk away quietly, Everett has branched out into writing, publishing two memoirs, made documentaries, provided the voice of Prince Charming in the Shrek films, and now taken on the role of writer, director and star of the new film The Happy Prince. Monocle's Ben Ryland met him recently to talk about it all.
The appreciation has been most intelligent.
Which persuades me that you think almost as highly of the play
as I do myself.
What is the name of this friend of yours?
Oscar.
Oscar Wilde. Oh, Jesus Christ.
I definitely planned to be famous. First of all, I decided I was Julie Andrews' daughter after I saw Mary Poppins. That went on for a bit. And then I stopped, and then when I started acting in the school plays, I built myself a dressing room on the fire escape, which had wig stands, makeup table, a mirror with bulbs around it, telegrams from famous people saying kind of good luck, darling, you're fantastic, two telephones, which I'd pick up and kind of talk to agents in Italy and stuff like that. And actually, it was all pretty accurate, really. And people would come up to my dressing room, and obviously everyone else in the school thought I was insane. And then the master who's in charge of fire, health and safety, dismantled it because it was on a fire escape. So I was back with the rest of them.
Why did you want to be famous? Even back then, what did you think being famous was?
Just being very glamorous and knowing Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn. And it was much smaller, kind of much more humble, really, than today's idea of fame. Yeah, being in Hollywood and starring with Julie Andrews, that was really all I really thought about. Being in a film with Julie Andrews.
So aside from Julie Andrews, who were the famous people that you were thinking of back then, who you were idolising? Who were the people that made you think, this is something I not only want, but could possibly have?
Well, Julie Andrews, really.
Just Julie?
Well, first, I know, that probably sounds a bit tragic, but yeah, at first really just Julie. Then a little bit later, at about the age of 14, when I went to a bigger school, we started seeing other things, and I then saw Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, and that kind of really did turn my head too, partly because I loved the way it looked. In the old days in England, every Saturday and Sunday there were old movies. Then I discovered Betty Davis, aged about 14 and a half, just as puberty was coming on, and that was very life-changing. Her in All This in Heaven 2, or her in Stolen Life, her in Dark Victory, all these things. I was just amazed by her. I went to London. I discovered things like the 50s, 1950s. James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift, A Place in the Sun. And that really was very head-turning too. And then I'd read about Montgomery Clift. And then my trajectory changed somewhat, because at first I wanted to be much more spit-spot, like Julie Andrews, and very conventional. But once I'd read about Montgomery Clift always having drinks full of mandrax and quaaludes and being off his face and having car crashes and being cradled by Elizabeth Taylor, I thought I wanted that. Endless, you know, suffering. I wanted to suffer, and be very tortured and not say anything and just, you know, be very generally very mysterious. So that's what I tried to do next.
There is something about the idolization of the tragedy and the suffering that goes into that. Was that, Does that play a part in what you would consider as the glamour of celebrity? There's this idea that there has to be something a little bit murky, a little bit tragic underneath it.
When we were kids, the whole thing was so different, and we worshipped suffering and smoking and having a hard time. All those stars like Marlon Brando, James Dean, Montgomery Clift, I Could Have Been a Contender. It was all about the glamorization of not managing to pull things off and suffering and being all wound up inside. And so I think that wasn't particularly unique to me. We worshipped that kind of black and white, silver screen sadness and madness. And Vivian Leigh was going off the rails, and we'd rejected kind of conventional theatre and conventional cinema. There were amazing films like A Taste of Honey and If and all those things in the UK. By the time I got to drama school, I wanted to be kind of a weird, freaky, beatnik, junky kind of character.
And what did you become? Or at least, how did you go about creating what you would eventually become?
I literally spent 1 year not wearing shoes. And I don't know how I managed to pull that off, because I'm so kind of foot phobic and sidewalk phobic now. I don't know, but I never wore shoes. I went out everywhere bare feet. I got into bed without washing those bare feet off the street. I kind of got very into going out in the 70s, it was a wonderful time in London in the 70s, really, because the gay scene was really quite different from now. It was very small. It was very classless for such a class-structured country. Because it was so small, everyone from any old area came to the same place. And you counted just for daring to go, in a way. I loved all that. I loved the outsiderishness of being gay, because even though we were just legalized 7 years before, it was still very much an outside world. And one looked at the real world as the enemy, almost. And that's quite luxurious. It's quite a fun perspective. And it was a time of punk, too. That was very exciting and verging on dangerous. You know, there was always the King's Road was always verging on being in a riot. Everything closed down on a Sunday, completely closed down, the whole of London. But it was a very exciting time. There were gay skinheads, tons of leather queens and cowboys and Indians and weird freaks everywhere. I had a kind of wonderful time right up until 1982 or 83, probably.
It's funny you mention James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift. They were all outsiders in their time as well for one reason or another. And somehow you were just speaking about how you were really idolizing that idea of being an outsider, and that I assume shaped a lot about who you've become today. Because tracing your career right back to its early beginnings, you've always had this element of rebelliousness. You've always carried that with you, and that's always helped to define so many of the projects that you've worked on.
Well, I think it definitely. My career was shaped as much as anything else by, you know, obviously by being gay, you know, because you had to be an outsider, really. It wasn't like being gay is now. It was something you really didn't talk about. It certainly wasn't something for an actor to talk about. And then on top of that, what happened was, you know, AIDS then came on the scene. So we were even more outside at the very beginning of AIDS, because AIDS coincided with a kind of wave of right-wing Republican politics in America, Mrs. Thatcher in England. Suddenly the gay community, which in the 70s had been kind of quite in vogue because of disco, because of Studio 54, because of just the general kind of ambience of New York City and London and Paris and Yves Saint Laurent, and, you know, gay ruled at a certain point in the 70s. It's similarly to black people also. They were absolutely all the rage in the 1970s because the music and the whole scene was kind of about black people and gay people in a way. But AIDS really knocked that on the head for the gays anyway. And we suddenly became lepers, really. And was a very strange ambience because, first of all, we were all terrorized because we saw friends of ours beginning to fall apart in the most dramatic and terrifying way. And also, we would notice that if we went to, I don't know, meals with families, you could notice someone surreptitiously taking your plate away to being washed separately, which, you know, was understandable. People were terrified. So I suppose that's what really made me, in the end, rebellious, because then, by that point, I was starting off in the cinema. My first film went fairly well. It was Another Country, and I was part of its inception. So it was a play that my best friend had produced in the West End, and I'd got him involved in it, and he produced it in the cinema. So I was kind of, I was in that film right at a kind of top level. But after that, I moved into more conventional cinema. And I suppose then I did become probably quite rebellious.
Did that reputation make things difficult for you? Because watching all of this playing out via the pages of the magazines, it didn't seem to be dampening your fortunes at all. And perhaps this, I suppose, is where your idolising of Marlon Brando and James Dean might come back in again. Because Rupert Everett, the rebel, the out gay man who says what he thinks, you made people sit up and listen.
But I felt people were rebelling against me, really, because I was, my next film was called Dance with a Stranger. And the director seemed to be making such a meal of the fact that I could tell he thought I didn't have a clue about sleeping with women. Actually, I had many more girlfriends than he had. He was a big old lumpy old lug. I didn't need to be patronized about how I was going to kiss the leading lady. It wasn't necessary. So I got into a very difficult relationship with that director, and that film changed the course of my career, because I suppose one felt very punk. You couldn't test for HIV at that point. You could only test for it in about 1986. So I think most people who'd had any kind of sexual life, they thought, well, quite possibly one's number was up. And it made you quite snappy and intolerant of anything going wrong in your world. So someone who was patronizing me in a way that normally or now I could deal with perfectly well, I, you know, just snapped back. I think that's when I got a reputation as being really difficult to deal with.
There are these ongoing assumptions that we have about gay people working in the mainstream entertainment world, and you've spoken about this very vocally in the past, that, you know, there's this idea that if you are openly gay, you can only play certain roles. If there's a gay character in a straight-themed sort of story, usually they can only occupy certain roles that are, you know, outwardly gay. For example, the gay best friend, as you know all about from your Hollywood films. From an early time, you must have been very aware of that. You must have known that you, being an out gay man who's, I assume, was never prepared to or never even considered that they could hide their sexuality, that was a governing part of who you were. You must have known from an early point that this was going to be something that would be steering many of the places that you would be going with your life.
No, I didn't, because until you get into show business, particularly then, the 70s, everyone felt we were on the verge of a whole new, you know, we'd had the 60s, the sexual revolution. It felt that the world was on the verge of change. My only perspective was from underneath the glitter ball of a, you know, sexually mixed disco scene. And, you know, the big discos in the world were bisexual at that point. The Studio 54, the Embassy in London, the Club Set, the Palace in Paris, they were everyone mixed together. So I didn't really have a sense going into show business quite what it was like. But once I was in, I did realize in that period there wasn't really the role of the gay best friend even. I mean, that came much, much later. There was only the role of keeping yourself in the closet, really. I think that's the only thing. If you wanted to go for stardom, you know, and I didn't want to go for just being a spear carrier. I wanted to carry the show rather than the spear.
So during production of Dance with a Stranger, which is the film you starred in with Miranda Richardson, released in 1985, you say things started to get quite difficult for you then. How so?
I thought I knew everything and about how everything was meant to be done. And so I don't think I was the easiest person, but then I came up against somebody who had a more woundable ego than me, which was my director. He really, I thought, was making my life hell, and then I decided to try and make his life hell too. He won, because then he told everyone after the movie that I was impossible to work with, and I really, and then he directed Four Weddings and a Funeral straight afterwards. So if I'd managed to learn how to, you know, lick ass in a kind of believable way, I would have, could have possibly got in there with a chance. But so I definitely blew things for myself there. Really had to go back to square one.
Sometime later, of course, you carved yourself out quite a career in Europe.
There was an amazing agent in Italy who put films together, and I met her through Susan Sarandon, and she took me on, and she put me into three or four really fantastic movies, kind of European movies. And that's when I thought, God, I should really not try Hollywood. I should try and become part of Europe. And Europe was meant to be getting going cinematically. 1989 was meant to be the year of European cinema. So I thought, well, I'll get in there early. Instead of having to compete with everyone over in England and America, I'll be on my own, basically. It's the only English-speaking, hopefully trilingual actor around. And it was a really clever plan, actually. But the thing was that 1989 didn't happen in the way that anyone thought it was. And there was no European cinema language discovered. And in fact, what you discovered about the European cinema is that every single country was so firmly entrenched in its own traditions and beliefs, particularly the French one, which was probably the financially driving force of European cinema. They were incredibly francophile and nationalistic and really didn't like any of the other cinemas. But anyway, I worked a lot in Italian-French co-productions, and then eventually there was this film going on in Russia made by a very famous old Russian director called Sergei Bondarchuk. And it was to play an incredibly macho Cossack. And there was a list of actors very long, and I was at the bottom of it. But because it was to be for a year and a half in Russia, because it was a kind of Soviet-styled film where you had a start date and only a very vague stop date, all the other actors turned it down. And they got to me at the very bottom of the list. So I did it.
Were any of those thoughts on your mind, knowing that you are someone who is openly gay, who doesn't hide who they are? Did you have any concerns about being in that sort of world where that might actually cause much bigger problems for you than you had experienced before?
Well, remember, though, when I went to Russia, it was still in the communist era. So there were, I don't think you felt afraid. They were pretty controlled people, and nothing much went on in Russia. So I didn't think about, you know, getting in trouble. What I found when I got there, I mean, it really was incredible. There was only one restaurant in Russia, in Moscow. You had to go to the Irish shop to get food. I got a flat in this building on the first night. My next-door neighbor burnt to death in his flat. He was an alcoholic, and all his furniture was put outside this building, kind of burnt-out lampshade and a burnt-out mattress, a burnt-out armchair. And this was, I think, August. And then autumn happened, and the autumn leaves fell on it, and then the snow came and fell on the, you just see the end of the lampshade. Then spring came the next year, and the snow went, and roots were growing up through the mattress of his bed. And you know, it was a very, it was an extraordinary time. Wondering about being gay wasn't an issue. I mean, being gay was like being a criminal. So there was two places to be gay at. You could go to the bar underneath the Bolshoi, where you could at your risk meet gay people. But the gays lived in these communities, and they were gay and criminal because there was no other choice for them but to be. So they were all, if you went with one, you normally got everything taken afterwards. And otherwise there was the loo underneath the Kremlin, which was quite a good cruising place too, but that was about it. I picked up somebody once only, right at the very beginning, and took him home to my flat where my dog was. He was absolutely terrified of my dog. Then he wanted to go in the bathroom. Then he wanted to turn all the taps on. Then he wanted to go behind the shower curtain. I mean, this is the levels of, you know, terror. And then he made off with my Walkman, which was fine afterwards. But I decided after that to kind of call that a day, really.
Your latest film, The Happy Prince, has you playing Oscar Wilde during his years in exile after being released from prison. And Well, I suppose it's hard not to see some similarities there. Here was a great talent, a man utterly unafraid of being exactly who he feels. And the price is his career. There's a wonderful moment in the film that really struck a chord with me. It's when Wilde is in France and he's in a confrontation with some rather nasty bullies who are harassing him, and he screams at them to go back to England because that's the natural habitat of the hypocrite. Is that tragic aspect of Oscar Wilde's story part of what speaks to you?
That's actually an Oscar Wilde line too, the natural habitat of the hypocrite is England, go back there. But yeah, I think the England that I came into show business-wise was very much that. It was the remains of the kind of royal court, kitchen sink drama, socialist show business. The BBC was very socialist. The royal court was quite socialist. But what people forget about the socialists, they weren't very gay-friendly either, actually. So a lot of directors, Tony Richardson, Anthony Page, they were all in the closet, a lot of those people in the royal court even. So being gay wasn't a good option, and nor was being upper middle class. The combination was fatal, actually. One or the other could have been okay, but the two together meant that you were never taken seriously. I felt, maybe I'm being subjective, but that was the feeling I got. There's something about that old British system that is very hypocritical, I think.
This idea that for some people, they can be accepted for their talent, but not necessarily for who they are. They're not really seen as a person, I suppose.
No, and also that a certain type of person is accepted. A certain type of person is anointed in our country, actually in all countries. You can be elected somehow, and who knows how this election happens. But you see them, and you see it a lot in the arts. You know, the elected, anointed folk. Some of them not remotely talented, in my opinion, but they're elected, and they can run for miles on an empty tank.
I suppose for someone like you, being that anointed person wasn't ever really an option, but then when you stand back and look at things now, being forced into that box as an outsider, as a rebel, that's part of what's really propelled you to where you are now, isn't it? What do you see when you look back at the young Rupert Everett?
In my own little world, I was the great expert on everything, which I wasn't, obviously, but that didn't help either. I had a very peculiar perspective on everything. I thought everybody was a junkie, you see, to start with, because I was brought up in a group where everybody of my generation, all the kind of upper-class kids, took heroin. I just thought that was normal. But I only realized later that it wasn't. And so my perspective on things was absolutely also a little bit verging on insane. I remember when I got my first modelling campaign, because modelling was quite successful for me, I went to do a Valentino campaign in Rome. But I hadn't worked out what the contract was. So they kept showing me the clothes. I said, I'd never wear that. I'm not wearing that. And eventually they were kind of like all whispering in corners, and I couldn't really understand why. I don't know what was going on. I was living so much my kind of fantasy of being me. I didn't understand I was there just to wear their clothes. I thought I was just meant to wear what I thought I could make look good or something like that. And so that turned into lots of things that I did turned into terrible dramas. And I remember Giancarlo Giometti, who's the number two of Valentino, was called down to the set and said, what's going on? Got really angry. And I said, I just don't like any of the clothes. And I thought I was somehow within my rights. But I wasn't, you know, I just got the whole thing wrong. So, you know, a lot of it was my fault too. But, you know, that's what being young is about, I suppose.
That was Rupert Everett speaking to Ben Ryland there. And The Happy Prince is in cinemas now.
Well, that all went rather quickly again, didn't it, Andrew?
I love Nina. It's interesting how you leave a country so young, but you're so already kind of, you know, stitched into its culture. And when she sings, you know, you would imagine that she'd lived her whole life in Rio. Really, really interesting. And what a great lineup of people today. Mr. Doonan, Mr. Everett.
Absolutely.
All star turns, including you, Marcus.
Oh, yeah, likewise, Andrew. It's been a pleasure. And sadly, it's all pretty much over now, because this is all for this edition, 467 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. Special thanks also to Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ben Rylan. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippi.
And goodbye from me, Jutak. Bye-bye.